One's a hard-drinking goofball with a heart of gold. The other is a straight-faced brute who'd rather punch his way out of things. And together, they host Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and you can guess which one this guy is.
Mike DiCrescio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I don't want to get into which one is which. We don't need to know who's the hard-drinking goofball and who's the brute force guy.
Right, right. We can just leave it up to the fates.
Yeah, exactly.
Leave it up to the audience to decide. Let's do it at a poll. Hashtag Twitter poll. If you, you know, which one do you think would be which? Hard-drinking goofball or straight-faced brute? Me or Mike? The two of us, podcast hosts, together on this journey raft that we call Film Bookcast and life.
You already did an intro, Mike. You don't need to do another intro. I think we know which one of us is the drinker.
That didn't give it away. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, essentially we start with some film news and then we move on to some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately. After that, we'll move on to our featured review. This week, we are reviewing the new film from director Shane Black, The Nice Guys. You excited, Mike?
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah, it's a good time to be alive.
Yeah, when... new Shane Black thing, yep. Always a good thing.
Yes, yes. So we're going to get into that in a little bit. Right now, it's time for film news.
It's time for film news!
All right, so for film news, we're going to get into some directing news first, and some of the big news coming out this past week. Gareth Edwards, director of Godzilla and Monsters, and who is directing the upcoming Star Wars Rogue One, is no longer directing Godzilla 2.
Yeah, that's I feel pretty interesting, considering I think Godzilla was that was his big breakout.
It was, yeah. I mean, Monsters was like it got him on the map. Like, that was his first movie. Right. It was an indie movie that very few people saw, but it was like a very good movie. And it got him the gig to do Godzilla, and Godzilla was huge, and everybody was really into Godzilla. Like, critically, it got a lot of response to that.
Right.
And I remember he was attached to Godzilla 2 pretty quickly after Godzilla came out. And then a little bit after that, he got attached to Star Wars Rogue One.
Right.
And I think the reason Godzilla 2 is coming out in 2018, which is kind of far away from Godzilla 1, is because he was doing Rogue One first. And now he's no longer doing Godzilla 2.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if that means anything for Godzilla 2. I doubt. I'm sure it's still going to happen.
Well, yeah, I think it'll still happen. They're looking for a new director now. But it seems like Gareth Edwards wants to make something smaller after Rogue One. You know, he's...
Right.
Just did two massive tentpoles with Godzilla and Star Wars, so you might need to like cool down a little bit.
Yeah.
Do something more on the scale of Monsters, I think, is what he would like to do. But I think part of the reason is also Godzilla 2 is going to start to take place in the Monster Cinematic Universe that
I was just going to say that. They're doing the Skull Island, right, I think?
Right, so Kong Skull Island is coming out in 2017, and then Godzilla 2... in 2018. I think actually Godzilla 2 is delayed till 2019, now that I'm thinking about it.
Okay.
And then in 2020, Godzilla versus Kong, which we've talked about on the podcast before,
right,
is coming out. So I feel like, you know, maybe Gareth Edwards didn't want his vision to be truncated by having to be part of, like, a larger picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who knows? I remember a while back, Godzilla, like, they were talking about Godzilla 2, and he was talking about the ideas that they had for that, and they were going to throw in, like, Mothra and Rodan and, like, a bunch of other... like classic Godzilla monsters.
Right. Yeah, I do remember that. I remember seeing that and thinking that Gareth Edwards is someone who like is in love with the Godzilla movies.
Right.
If he was going to go that far. But I guess now that he realizes it's going to have to fit into Kong and all the other stuff that he's out.
Right, right. So that's Gareth Edwards no longer directing Godzilla 2. Not directing Godzilla 2. I was about to say, that's Gareth Edwards directing Godzilla 2. But that would be the opposite of what we just said. So,
nope.
He's no longer directing Godzilla 2. However, there is some interesting news coming out. So, are you a fan of the Halloween franchise, Mike?
Yes.
Like,
I couldn't think of a joke at all. I had to say yes.
Yes. I've actually only seen the first two, like the original two Halloweens. And I loved the first one, and I did not like the second one. And I haven't seen anything past that. So, I don't know much about Halloween past Halloween 2. But Halloween 2 I thought was garbage, so...
That's fair.
But that said, you know, John Carpenter directed the original Halloween, and the big news that came out the other day is that John Carpenter is returning to the Halloween franchise, not as director, but as a producer, and he's going to be producing the new Halloween movie for Blumhouse, which is a production company, like low-budget horror production company that has come out with, like, Insidious and Sinister. Was Paranormal Activity them? I think Paranormal Activity was them, too.
Yeah.
And a lot of other, like,
yeah,
stuff.
I think they were.
You know, they've made a name for themselves as, like, kind of the low-budget horror movies that turn out a profit. And so that's pretty cool. Like, it's interesting. It's an odd pairing. I didn't think that would be happening anytime soon. Like, because John Carpenter hasn't made a movie since 2010 with The Ward, and that was not a good movie. So.
Yeah. Yeah, he's executive producing it, right?
He is producing and possibly doing the score.
I think that's the most important part.
That is pretty cool. I mean, John Carpenter composed the score for the original Halloween.
Yeah.
He composed the score for many of his own films. And, like, as of the past few years, he's mostly, like, going around touring with his band.
Yeah.
Instead of actually making movies, which is what he's more interested in now.
Yeah, they also put out a couple special, I don't know if they're just on vinyl, but the special releases, The Lost Themes, I think it's what it's called. Which is stuff that he composed and wrote for movies but never used. And they just put out Volume 2, just came out this year. So if you're into John Carpenter's creepy-ass music, go check those things out because they're pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I also just listened to the I Was There 2 episode with PJ Souls. I don't remember if that's her actual name. Who is one of the friends in Halloween. And they talked. And it was really awesome to just hear all about the, you know, how they made Halloween for, like, no dollars.
$0.
Yeah. Yeah. So check that out, too, if you're into Halloween stuff.
Absolutely. And by putting this with Blumhouse, it seems like it's going back to that kind of low-budget aesthetic of Halloween, which, you know, Halloween movies since then, since the original, have kind of ballooned out of control. You know, they've had, like, there was a lot of different things with Halloween. I know Halloween 3 was Season of the Witch, which did not have Michael Myers in it.
Right.
And the idea was that it would be like an anthology series, and then that didn't work, so they went back to Michael Myers.
Yeah.
And then there was like Halloween H2O, there was the Rob Zombie Halloween remakes.
I actually like those.
Did you?
Yeah, they're really gross and messed up, though, because it's Rob Zombie. But it'll be interesting to see what a new take on Halloween will be with some influence of John Carpenter sprinkled into it.
Absolutely. And that new take could come courtesy of Mike Flanagan, who is the director of this movie Hush that I talked about in the podcast last time we met. And that's a great choice, I think. He's an awesome horror director. He directed Hush, which was great. I mean, I was super into that movie. It's really intense and really scary. It's very like almost like Halloween in a lot of ways. And so I'm pretty excited to see what he does with this. He's also directing Ouija 2, which is coming out this year, which... I didn't see Ouija. I heard pretty terrible things.
Yeah.
But Mike Flanagan was not involved with Ouija. He's doing Ouija 2. So who knows? Ouija 2 could be pretty good.
It seems like of all the, like, branded board game movies, like Battleship and stuff, to make Ouija board?
I think the problem with doing a movie based on Ouija boards is that Ouija boards are already part of a lot of horror movies.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, like there's a scene in Paranormal Activity where they're just messing around with the Ouija board.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. And so it's like you're adapting like a scene from various horror movies into like one feature length movie. And it's,
yeah,
you know, but then again, I didn't see Ouija. It could be great.
Probably not.
It's probably not, but like it could be. I don't. I can't judge something lest ye be judged. But anyway, Mike Flanagan doing new Halloween is pretty cool news, and he also directed Oculus a couple years ago, which was a movie that got pretty solid critical reviews. I remember not being a fan, but as I said when I was talking about Hush, I might have been really drunk when I watched Oculus. Yeah. I don't remember.
So you probably were really drunk.
I probably was the hard drinking goofball over here.
See, you're building the case, Mike.
All right, let's move on to next news, and that's Marvel news, which at this point we should probably just make a theme song for Marvel news.
I feel like we need a bumper for just
but there's a lot of Marvel news, as there always is. And so this past week, the cast for Thor Ragnarok was officially announced, like the main cast. And so you got your usuals. You got Chris Hemsworth, Tom Hiddleston, Anthony Hopkins is back as Odin. Mark Ruffalo, as we know, is in the movie as the Hulk and has a pretty substantial role. One person who's not in this movie is Natalie Portman, who is in the first two Thor movies as Jane Foster, Thor's girlfriend.
Right.
And so that's interesting. I don't really know what's like. You know, it's weird that they would try to get us to invest in his relationship with Jane Foster and then just be like, she's not in it.
Yeah, she's not in it. Well, I feel like I remember Thor 2, Natalie Portman saying that she was like out. She didn't want any part of it.
Right. Yeah. She was not on board for Thor 2, and then she was in it. But the reason for that is that Thor 2 was originally had Patty Jenkins as director. She was a female director, and that's Natalie Portman wanted to support that. I think she had the choice of getting Patty Jenkins into this fold, and then Patty Jenkins left the project and is now directing Wonder Woman, actually. So Natalie Portman was already like in the movie, basically, when Patty Jenkins left. She was contractually obligated. So now it seems like Natalie Portman doesn't want in anymore. And it doesn't seem like there's going to be a ton of room for her character anyway, because Thor 3 is supposedly going to take place like 90% not on Earth.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Right. But like the other Thor movies have pretty much like have been like half and half. Like you'll see a lot of Asgard, you'll see a lot of Earth. This time around, it's going to be Asgard and a cosmic space journey.
It's a space road trip movie between the Hulk and Thor.
That is what Mark Ruffalo has been saying. But it seems like the villain of this movie is going to be played by Cate Blanchett, who's playing Hela, which is crazy good casting. Also, Jeff Goldblum is in this movie, and Carl Urban. And this is turning into be like one of the weirdest, craziest casts
And it's stacked,
in the Marvel
too.
Movies. Yeah, it's nuts.
It's really awesome. I think that I was reading up on what Jeff Goldblum's character is. He's one of the... Not the ancients. I can't remember.
I forget his character's name, but he's tied to, in the comics, he's tied to the collector from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. He's like this weird, bizarre, like character that exists from before time. Like Jeff Goldblum's the perfect guy.
Yeah. Like imagine one day we get like a scene between Jeff Goldblum and Benicio del Toro, just decked out in like ridiculous costumes. Just talking about Infinity Stones and being like, Infinity Stones, I'm Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, I think we're going to get that.
It's going to be pretty wild. Also, Tessa Thompson's in this movie, who was just great in Creed last year.
Right.
So that should be pretty cool. I know she's playing an Asgardian warrior. And it seems like a lot of people were wondering whether the Warriors 3 would be back. Jamie Alexander, Sif, Fandral, and Volstagg. And it seems like at least Jamie Alexander will be back.
Yes, she saw that.
She wasn't in the press release, but she's hinting that she's in the movie.
It's going to be so good.
Yeah, so I'm actually pretty excited for this. And I don't know if you, director of this movie, Taika Waititi, was the director of What We Do in the Shadows.
Okay, I haven't seen that yet. I know that everyone loves it. So.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Did you not know that Taika Waititi was directing this movie, that he directed... Your face was like, what?
No, I did not know that he was directing it.
Yeah, he just directed this movie called Hunt for the Wilder People, which just came out, or it's coming out. It just played at Sundance and got phenomenal reviews as well. And yeah, he's been on Twitter just being hilarious, like trolling people about this movie. And he's been like tweeting at other Marvel directors. Like he tweeted at James Gunn and Peyton Reed saying like, hey, guys. Is there like a mandated number of explosions I'm supposed to put into the Marvel movie? I have one so far, but it's not so much of an explosion. It's more of a boink sound.
Oh, this is what Twitter exists for.
Yeah, it's awesome. So it's like I follow all the Marvel directors that are like working on these movies because it's just fun to watch them like banter back and forth.
Yeah.
So definitely take away TJ's Twitter account. It's hilarious. He's being really funny. definitely Thor 3 is shaping up to be pretty good. Like it's, Everything I'm hearing about this movie makes it sound really good. And that's cool, because the Thor movies, I feel like, have been like kind of the underdog of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Like, I've enjoyed them. I liked Thor 1 a lot when it first came out. And Thor 2, it's like a fun time.
Right.
It's nothing like to write home about. I think it's definitely one of the weakest of the Marvel movies.
Right.
So I'm excited for Thor 3 to really, like, do justice to Thor. You know?
I hope so, yeah. Yeah, I think there's a new Film Crit Hulk... article out about Marvel Phase 2 and 3 sort of, about how phase one was about really actually storytelling and setting up this world, and then phase two and three have kind of shifted to let's just have fun and kind of gotten rid of storytelling and actual stakes and right. stuff.
I did read that article too, yeah.
So it's pretty interesting now. I'm excited, I think, the way shit has to go for Thanos. We've got it's got to be, like, real scary and everything. So I right. think we're going to start moving towards that, especially since Thor Ragnarok is, I guess, going to be about the end of the world, possibly, because that's what Ragnarok is.
Theoretically, or the end of Asgard, anyway.
Right. So hopefully it is good.
Hopefully, yes. Hopefully it is good. And speaking of things that hopefully are good, and things that I'm pretty confident will be good, Black Panther is also casting right now. And so we already knew Chadwick Boseman was going to be in this movie as Black Panther, and he just killed it in Civil War, so that's very exciting. We knew that Ryan Coogler is directing this movie, who just directed Creed, and that's awesome. And we started to get casting of, like, new people in this movie. Lupita Nyong'o is going to be in this movie as Black Panther's love interest. And Michael B. Jordan is going to be playing the villain, it seems like.
Oh, really? I didn't hear that part.
I think that's a rumor as of right now, but he is in the movie.
Yeah.
And that is awesome. This is, like, three of the best black actors working today.
Yeah.
Just put into one, like, big, high-scale, big superhero action movie.
Yeah, it's going to be phenomenal.
It's very exciting. And the fact that Ryan Coogler's directing it, it's Creed reunion. Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler, so... It's very exciting. There's a rumor that John Boyega was actually going to be in this movie as well.
I did hear that, yeah.
I think that turned out to be false. It just seemed like he was just taking a meeting with Marvel. Right. And I'm sure he's super busy with Star Wars anyway.
Yeah, I don't know if he has enough time. But it's awesome that Michael B. Jordan 1 is now crossing over franchises.
Right. That's the second Human Torch to switch over to the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, how many Disney-owned movies is Lupita Nyong'o in now? It's like 1,000.
Well, Star Wars in this. But and Jungle Book, also.
And Jungle Book, yeah. But it's going to be... It's awesome. Well, I'm so excited.
I think in this one she won't be motion capture, though, which so that's...
Oh, it'll actually be her?
Hopefully, unless she's, like, playing some kind of shriveled alien or something. Or she's playing an actual Black Panther.
What if she plays young... Maz Kanata.
That's the way to bring the universes together.
That's how they connect it.
It all comes back to Maz.
That's it.
It's all Maz connecta.
But we'll allow it.
Anyway, so yeah, and also Marvel news. There's been a lot of back and forth with this over the past couple weeks. Michael Keaton is in talks to play the villain in Spider-Man Homecoming. Which is really cool, but like it was like Michael Keaton's in talks, and everybody was like, "Yay, maybe he's playing the Vulture," because that was like a rumor.
Yeah.
And then, as soon as like that stuff came out, they were like, they like backtracked and was like, "Michael Keaton's not in Spider-Man: Homecoming anymore. Things didn't work out. He's not in it." And everybody's like, "Oh, oh well." And then like a week later, he's like, "Hey, Michael Keaton's back in Spider-Man: Homecoming." Everybody's like, "What?" Okay.
Yeah. Yay! I think it's gonna be awesome. I'm excited for him to return to comic book movies.
Yes, yeah, I'm very excited. And, you know, the rumors that he's playing the Vulture, which is odd because he was just Birdman.
Right.
And also the fact that Birdman was, like, a pretty, like, that decried superhero culture.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty heavily. And so it's interesting that Michael Keaton was in that, like, kind of lamenting his role in the Batman franchise.
Yep.
And is now going to be just returning to the superhero movies with Spider-Man.
Yeah, he's had must have a very... A long talk with his therapist about it.
Over his many bags of money that they're probably paying him. Right. And that'll make him another actor to jump from DC to Marvel or Marvel to DC. You know, we talked about that with J.K. Simmons a while back. He was J. Jonah Jameson. Now he's Commissioner Gordon. And then, you know, there's other ones too. Ryan Reynolds, Green Lantern, and Deadpool.
There you go.
And so many things.
Oh, man. If only we knew how to end a segment.
If only. But you know what? The segment's not over yet, because there's one more piece of film news.
Okay.
And that is that Warner Brothers... We're out of Marvel news now. Warner Brothers...
And what's even the point?
has put Geoff Johns in charge of the DC film universe.
Okay. So explain who Geoff Johns is.
So Geoff Johns is basically in charge of DC Comics right now. and has been for the last several years. He's also worked on the DC television series Arrow and The Flash and all those. And he actually had a hand in a few DC movies. He's the one co-writing The Batman with Ben Affleck. Everybody's referring to it as The Batman, even though the title hasn't been announced yet. But that's what it is right now. So he's co-writing that movie, and he's actually right now writing DC Universe Rebirth, which is rebooting the DC Universe again.
Of course.
And in that reboot, it seems like it's going to go for a much lighter tone than what it has over the past few years with the New 52.
Right.
And that's great news for me, because I am not a fan of the New 52 at all. I think it's pretty much garbage.
Wow.
Like, all around. I'm not a fan. And so the fact that he's making that lighter is encouraging to me, that he's, like, in charge of the movies now, because I feel like he's, you know, he's been a dark writer in the past. He's written a lot of dark stuff, but I think he's starting to see the value of, you know, kind of just joy in these superhero stories. And, like, there is a balance between being serious and being fun that you can strike. And, you know, these DC movies have gone, like, way overboard into the seriousness with Zack Snyder. Yeah. And they've kind of lost what makes these characters enjoyable to be around, as we saw a few months ago with Batman vs. Superman.
Right. I think the DC executive people, they have to be hearing the fans and everyone shouting out, like, please make these fun, instead of making them so dour.
It definitely seems like that. And that's why, like, Suicide Squad went back for reshoots to add more jokes.
Right.
And that's why apparently WB is considering a Harley Quinn spinoff from Suicide Squad. And they're actually looking to Suicide Squad for, like, dozens of potential spinoffs. Like, they just see all those characters. It's like, if one of those characters breaks out, they're getting a movie. Like, that's kind of, that's kind of what they're at. I would not be surprised if, like, DC's entire film slate that's, like, upcoming was just, like, totally rewritten for something else. Because right now you've got Wonder Woman filming. You've got Justice League Part 1 filming. Aquaman's on the way with James Wan. And then outside of that, it's kind of like, you know, projections. Like, the Flash movie is supposed to come out at some point, but right now has no director. They're talking about a Green Lantern movie again, which worked so well the first time. They've got, like, a Cyborg movie on the horizon. But, like, they're so far in the future that, like, they could take them off the schedule and replace them with movies that people might actually want to see. You know, like, if Harley Quinn breaks out in Suicide Squad, which she probably will, because, like, if there's a character who's as popular as Deadpool in comics, it's probably Harley Quinn. You know, just, like, in terms of, like, internet phenomena.
I think people want these kind of smaller, silly movies. We've had 13 The World Is Gonna End Marvel movies. Well, they're not all about that, but, you know, they kind of all follow that formula.
A lot of them, yeah.
And, you know, Deadpool was just the smallest stakes. Like, the guy wanted revenge because his face looks dumb now. Like, the DC films could be saved, but I don't have a lot of hope. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. We'll see what happens. There's a lot of talent behind those movies, and if you got Jeff Johns in charge, things could work out. Like, Suicide Squad looks pretty good. And, you know, you got James Wan doing Aquaman, which at least that has a lot of potential because James Wan's great. Yeah. So, you know, we'll see what happens. We will see what happens.
I think if Suicide Squad delivers the kind of movie that the trailer set to Bohemian Rhapsody sets forth, like, if it delivers on that kind of film, they'll be in really good shape.
Hopefully, yeah. It's weird that the entire DC universe is basically revolving around Suicide Squad to save it now.
Yeah.
Like, you made a movie with Batman and Superman. That was supposed to be, like, your magnum opus. You know? And now you're relying on this, like, weird movie based on an obscure comic with a bunch of, like, D-list supervillains.
Yep. It'd be like if the whole Marvel universe hinged on Guardians.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Ant-Man saves the day.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But anyway, so I guess that about wraps up film news, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, that wraps up film news. Let's move on into our discussions.
These are my discussions.
Just when I thought I could talk about movies all day, I talked about more, so we're gonna talk about them today.
These are my discussions.
There is so much to see you and me, so we're gonna talk about movies for our
discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions today on the Film Bookcast, where we discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately. So, Mike, why don't you go first?
Okay. So, if there's a thing that consumes your whole life and emotionally destroys you, it's probably Game of Thrones.
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that one. So Game of Thrones has been airing its sixth season. Yes. It's five episodes in, so it's exactly halfway down the line. Yep. So, Mike, what are your overall thoughts on this season of Game of Thrones so far?
The first episode, you know, Game of Thrones always kind of falls into this, you know, the first two or three episodes are kind of set up, and they feel a little like you're treading water because you're kind of, you haven't seen these 1,000 characters in a year, and you kind of forget who's where and what's going on.
Right, so it's trying to catch you up on what's going on.
Right, and move some story forward, and then it just eviscerates you for the whole rest of the season. And it's following that trend again, and it's amazing. But I'm glad season six so far seems like the plot lines that actually feel like they've been treading water for six seasons, where like, hey, it's just a family trying to get more power, which I guess is the whole thing.
But, yeah.
But stuff is actually happening that is like that was set up in season one,
right?
And, like, been kind of hinted at, and like wink wink nudge nudge, this is going to happen eventually.
Yep.
And it's things are happening finally, and that feels awesome. I'm glad that's happening, because I don't know if I would have been able to keep going and hoping past seasons, you know what I mean? If it had just like this threat from season one will happen eventually, and we're in season 8 or 9 and like that hasn't happened yet, I would have been real mad.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if something like that had happened, I would have been upset. But luckily, season six seems to be going in a direction that those conflicts will be at least starting to resolve or coming right to an actual conflict instead of just being like a hint at a conflict.
Yes, yeah, we're getting very close to the end of the series. I think like there's maybe like one or two more seasons after this, and then it's done. Like I know it's renewed for season seven. I feel like it'll go to season eight and then call it a day.
Yeah, we're past the books at this point.
Yeah, that's one of the big things about the season, is that this is the first post-book Game of Thrones season, and I think they're killing it. Like, they are just flying through whatever plot they've got outlined.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's making moves, and I think that is why the show is being able to seem to start to move towards a conclusion, I think, is because they don't have, 1,000 bajillion pages of George R. R. Martin to sift through.
And right.
So hopefully the fact that they're, you know, beyond the books helps them be able to just finish the story. Like, I'm pretty sure it's been talked about that George R. R. Martin told the writers of the show what the conclusion of the story will be.
Yes.
So I guess sucks if you're waiting on the books, because it's going to happen in the show.
Yep. Yeah, but, yeah. I mean, I have one of our good friends, EJ, is a huge fan of both the show and the books. And, you know, he was very conflicted about whether he was going to watch the show this season, because he was thinking he might want to read in the books. But he's watching the show, and he's glad he is, because it's like, you know, you're getting, I feel like you're getting so much out of the show right now. Like, it's payoff after payoff after payoff, it feels like. Like, it's finally, like, resolving a lot of the storylines that's been building up towards. While still building on the story as well. Like, there's still a lot to go through for the future of the show. But it's moving at a much quicker pace than it has in the past, which is very exciting to me.
Yes, absolutely. Those are my thoughts put in a good way.
you did a fine job, Mike. You did a fine job. Oh,
thanks, Mike.
But is there anything in this season that, like, has really stood out to you? Like, anything that's, like, been, like, tremendously great?
Not to give away a specific plot point, or to avoid giving away a specific plot point, but, like, we've got time travel.
right.
How we discover that, I'll leave up to how you to watching the show. But, like, that's a thing now.
That is a thing.
Has insane implications for the whole rest of the show.
Yes, and I'll bring this up because I feel like this is in the cultural consciousness. Jon Snow was dead at the end of season 5.
Right.
And he was returned back to life at the beginning of season 2. Did you think that was handled well? Because I know a lot of people were very dissatisfied with that whole arc. And I found myself really enjoying it. But what did you think?
Oh, yeah. Of course that was amazing. I mean, I don't know. I could see people being upset about it. It's called A Song of Ice and Fire for a reason.
Right. He's the ice.
His name is Snow, so like Yeah, I think he's going to be the hero at the end.
Right.
And I thought that was done really well too. The episode before we learned some stuff about I'm afraid this is, Game of Thrones is like one of the sacred no spoiler shows for me, and I don't want to say stuff.
We learned stuff about Redacted, who but redacts.
I thought it was handled very well.
Yes. Yeah. I also really enjoyed it. I know a lot of people didn't, but I think a lot of people felt like his death was like a cheat because it was obvious he was coming back.
Yeah.
And I do think it was obvious he was coming back. I never thought for a second that he was dead. Because there was a lot of ways he could come back, and and the show went the way that everybody expected it to, I think that's fine. Like, it's not it to me. It didn't feel like Glenn's quote unquote death in The Walking Dead this year, where they pretended Glenn died and then he was just not there for a couple episodes, and then it turned out he didn't die, and that was like that was it. Like, this Jon Snow was actually dead, and they had to like jump through hoops to get him back.
Yeah, it felt pretty earned.
Yeah, to me it felt right.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that stuff from, like, I think season 3 is when that ability is introduced or, like, talked about. And, like, now there's another character, Blackfish, who's been brought up in season 6 that we haven't seen since season 3.
Right.
And, like, there's stuff like that, which is why I feel like this show is just kind of like, hey, let's see how convoluted we could have got. It was like this. Like, let's see how convoluted we could get and see, like, what people like to, like, really diminish the story. But, like, 3 seasons later, shit is coming up from. And it's hard to keep track of that, which is why I'm glad stuff is moving towards the conclusion.
Yes,
not that I haven't been enjoying every second of it.
But you're just exhausted, is what you're
saying. Yeah, I feel kind of I'm gonna be relieved when the show is over.
If you watch Game of Thrones live, you get the previously on Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Which is like 10 minutes long.
It is 10 minutes long and also
super necessary. Like, it's
very, I have such a love hate with that because, like, if there's been a thing that hasn't been talked about in a while, it'll be in the previously on, which you know means it's going to be in that episode.
Right.
been characters we haven't seen in for a while, and then they're like, previously on Game of Thrones, and we see what happened to that character, and you're like, oh yeah, that guy's coming back. Which is fine, I get it. Right. Like, it's fine.
Because otherwise you'll probably, like, forget who these characters are.
I would have no idea who they were. Exactly.
Alright, so that's Game of Thrones, airing right now on HBO. Season 6, off to a great start, I think. The first half was fantastic. I'm really looking forward to seeing what they do. And then my discussion is a movie I went to see this past weekend called Neighbors 2 Sorority Rising.
Tell us about it, Mike.
I will. So this is the new sequel to Neighbors, starring Seth Rogen, Rose Byrne, Zac Efron. This one adds Chloe Moretz to the fold as well. And I genuinely regard the first Neighbors as like a modern comedy classic. I love it. It's so good. It's so funny. It's fantastic. Rogen and Efron are hilarious. And Rose Byrne is amazing in that movie. Honestly, Rose Byrne deserved like an Oscar nomination for Neighbors.
Wow.
And I mean that sincerely. So this is the sequel to that movie, and it's basically exactly the same as the first one. So the first movie, the plot of that movie is that Zac Efron is in charge of this frat who moves into a house right next to Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne's house. And they have a newborn baby. They're not a fan of the frat living next door because they party and make noise all the time. And they basically go to war with each other.
Okay.
This movie, the frat is out of the house. They left the house at the end of the first movie. Spoilers for Neighbors. And in this movie, this new movie starts up, and that house, as the beginning of this movie, is vacant. It's a few years later. Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne are trying to sell their house. And just as that happens, Chloe Moretz and a group of girls have started their own sorority. And move right into the house right next to Rogen and Rose Byrne, and they have to deal with pretty much the same thing they dealt with in the first movie.
Okay.
But it's with girls instead of guys this time. And I thought it was really funny. It's a really funny movie. It's not like as fresh as the first movie. I don't think it's as good. But it's also got a surprisingly progressive message for a big dumb studio comedy.
Okay.
The big thing about it is that the reason that Chloe Moretz and her girls start their own sorority and move into this house is because there's a rule in America, and this is actually true, where sororities aren't allowed to throw parties.
What?
Yeah, that's a that is treated with the exact same amount of incredulity in the movie because it's ridiculous. And so the movie starts off with Chloe Moretz trying to join a sorority and then discovering that they're not allowed to throw parties with alcohol. And so they go to a frat party and becomes like really, and they're not comfortable there. They find it really weird and like sexist and weird and discomforting. And so
just like every frat party.
Yeah, exactly. And so she ends up starting her own sorority, like outside the system where they can have their own parties.
Okay.
And so that's the idea behind it. And the movie begins with Zac Efron working with them. And then eventually they kick him out. He switches sides to Seth Rogen's side. And it's pretty great. And it's like, you know, it's like openly feminist and it openly like calls out sexist practices, especially in terms of the frat, that was in the first movie. Like there'll be a scene at the beginning where, when Zac Efron first meets Chloe Moretz's character, and he's like, oh yeah, this is my old house. You know, I used to have a frat out here. Like it was great. We had parties all the time. And she was like, yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to get away from. And he's like, what? No, parties are great. We had themes like, boats and hoes, like strippers and hoes and all this stuff. And she's like, Chloe Moretz is like, that's really, you know, that's really sexist. And Zac Efron's like, what? No, it's not. And then he like thinks about it for a second. He's like, oh my God, you're right.
That's awesome. That's,
and so there's a lot of like male characters like openly feeling guilty for their past sexism. One character comes out as gay in between movies. And it's not treated as a big deal. Like it's openly embraced and it's not like made the butt of a joke or anything like that.
That's cool.
And it's pretty wild. And also the movie's just really, really funny. Chloe Moretz is really funny in the movie. It's getting back to like her R-rated roots with Kick-Ass.
Right.
Which is pretty nice. And Seth Rogen is hilarious. Always Rose Byrne. I feel like Rose Byrne didn't get as much to do in this movie as she did in the first movie, but she still has a lot of very funny lines. And so, yeah, overall, just a really funny, enjoyable comedy sequel. And that's hard to do. Like, comedy sequels are tough to pull off because it's hard to, like, recreate the lightning in the bottle of the first movie.
Right.
So definitely Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising. I would say definitely check it out if you're a fan of the first Neighbors because it's a very funny time. All right. Yeah. And so that's our discussions. Let's move on to our featured review, Mike, of The Nice Guys.
Equanimity. Quality of being calm.
Who is it?
Messenger service.
Even tempered.
March, we're gonna play a game.
I think you're in the wrong house.
Oh, it's called Shut Up Unless You're Me.
I love that game.
You're a private investigator?
Just 20 bucks in there, all right? Just take it.
No, I'm not here for that. I'm a messenger. Give me your left arm.
No.
Yeah, come on.
No.
When you're talking to your doctor,
no.
Tell him you have a spiral fracture.
No.
Deep breath.
No.
I'm not in the yellow pages. If you got trouble with someone, you might ask around for me, Jackson Healy.
That was from the trailer for The Nice Guys, the new film from director Shane Black, written by Shane Black and Anthony Bagarozzi. It stars Russell Crowe, Ryan Gosling, Angourie Rice, Matt Bomer, Margaret Qualley, Keith David, and Kim Basinger, among others. The IMDb plot synopsis reads, a mismatched pair of private eyes investigate the apparent suicide of a fading porn star in 1970s Los Angeles.
Just like any good detective story.
Right, yeah. So, Mike, are you a fan of Shane Black?
Yeah, I feel like I've come to realize that my awareness of Shane Black is tragically low. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, however, is one of my favorite movies. But then also you showed me Long Kiss Goodnight, which was incredible. And but apparently he's had a hand in like every modern action movie.
Yeah, he's some of the most memorable ones. Yeah, he actually doesn't have that many movies. You know, he was originally mostly well known for Lethal Weapon, which he wrote. He wrote Lethal Weapon and co-wrote Lethal Weapon 2. And then he wrote a movie called The Last Boy Scout with Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans. And then he also wrote Last Action Hero with Arnold Schwarzenegger. He wrote The Monster Squad, which is a movie from the 80s, and wrote The Long Kiss Goodnight. And then after Long Kiss Goodnight, he didn't work for like 9 years as a writer or a director. But then in 2005, he made his feature debut as a director, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which was awesome. It's like super great. Loved it. It's really, really great. It's really just a fantastic movie. I can't stress enough how good Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is.
Seriously.
And then even after that, he didn't work again for another, like, 8 years until he directed Iron Man 3.
Yeah, I also heard that he was kind of like a uncredited behind-the-scenes dude on Iron Man, because Robert Downey Jr. had just made Kiss Kiss Bang Bang with him.
Yes, this is true.
And they couldn't figure out what to do with Iron Man, so him and Jon Favreau just went to Shane Black's house and were like, hey, help us make this movie. And he yes, did.
That is true. That is actually true. And so Shane Black ended up directing Iron Man 3 based on Robert Downey Jr.'s recommendations. And I think Iron Man 3 is like, it's my favorite Iron Man. And it's, I think, one of the best Marvel movies. It's also a controversial one.
Yeah, that's a hot take, Mike.
I don't know. My opinion is that, like, really hardcore comic book fans tend to not like Iron Man 3 because of the big Mandarin twist.
Right.
But I find that fans of movies, you know, people who aren't, like, affixed to the internet 24/7, are generally big fans of Iron Man 3.
There you go.
To me, it seems that way. I think it's a very crowd-pleasing movie, and it is very Shane Blacky, which is part of why I like it so much. And also, The Long Kiss Goodnight is one of my favorite action movies ever. Like, I showed that movie to you. It is awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah. And so The Nice Guys is right within Black's wheelhouse. Like, it's a buddy comedy, detective story using Hollywood as a backdrop. It's got crackling dialogue, a seedy underground community, political distrust, a kid sidekick, super violence. It's like everything that's ever been in a Shane Black movie kind of, like, combined into one.
Yep.
Shane Black movie. It even works in Christmas a little bit.
I was going to say, even Christmas is in it.
Yeah, so I loved The Nice Guys. It is a blast from start to finish. I think Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling are terrific together. The mystery is really engaging, and it's got some of the biggest laughs I've had in a theater in a while.
Yeah, I agree with all of those words. Yeah, it touches on the kind of self of the hard-boiled detective story of, like, the rough and tough, you know, hard drinking story about the seedy porn underbelly of Hollywood, but it is also pretty self-aware of what's going on. It is just like ludicrous goofball stuff happening on top of all that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, Shane Black takes such delight in, like, subverting viewer expectations.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the things in, like, all of his movies is, like, you know, we'll do this thing, and in most movies this will happen, but in my movie this will happen.
Right.
It'll totally take you for a loop. And so, like, when you first meet Ryan Gosling, he punches his fist through a window to try to break in somewhere. And in most movies, that would work.
Yep.
You know, and instead, he is rushed to the emergency room for massive blood loss. And that's just, like, one of the things that happens in this movie. Like, there is so many moments in this movie.
And that happens about 4 minutes into the movie.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things, too, about Shane Black's dialogue and just stuff like that, where somebody will say, like, one of the guys will say something, and the other one will stop and be like, what? What? Like, why would you say that? And, like, explain why he's wrong about something.
Right.
Like, one of my favorite, from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, when, who is it? I don't remember the exact line, but somebody's like, oh, I feel badly about that. And Val Kilmer's like, badly is an adverb, don't use it there. And, like, they just explain what his grammar is wrong. And just moments like that are hilarious.
Yeah,
and
that's,
totally.
Yeah, that's a running thing in this movie as well, with Gosling and his daughter. Yeah, she keeps describing things, and it's like, oh, there's porn stars here and stuff. And Gosling is like, don't say and stuff, just say there's porn stars here.
Right. Exactly. Things like that are amazing, and my favorite parts of Shane Black.
Yes, absolutely. And part of what I love about this movie is it never loses, like, its totally cynical worldview, which I really appreciate. I think Crow and Gosling, I don't think changed that fundamentally as characters by the end.
No.
But they both kind of move forward in their story, and they both, like, kind of develop, but also, like, they're basically the same people.
Yeah, like, you can even say Russell Crowe's character regresses, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the joke, I think, is, you know, and we'll get to that in spoilers a little bit. There's that. Also, the kid sidekick, Holly, Gosling's daughter, is the best. She's so
good. Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah, she crushes it in this.
Yeah, she's fantastic. And that's something that Iron Man 3 had as well with the little kid that Robert Downey Jr. Befriends, named Harley, who actually, that kid has a cameo in this movie as the kid in the beginning.
Oh, really?
Who discovers the porn actress.
Right.
He's also, you may recognize him from Jurassic World. He was the little kid in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
There you go. It's all coming together now, Mike.
It's all coming together. This is the Ty Simpkins podcast, actually. That's what we're actually here to discuss. The lengthy career of Ty Simpkins, star of Iron Man 3, Jurassic World, and Insidious. He's the kid from Insidious.
Wow. Kids in everything.
Yeah. I also know way too much about this kid's career, I guess.
You got to get off IMDb, Mike. That's enough.
That's what it is. I feel like Kent from Veep, where it just where I just rattle off information that nobody cares about. But yeah, so he has a cameo in this movie, which is kind of cool. But yeah, Holly kind of continues in that tradition of like being like the precocious kid sidekick, which in most movies is like the most annoying trope.
Yeah,
to have like a precocious kid sidekick, but here it's great, and I think part of it is that she's like put in these very adult situations.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's face it, she's the most mature character in the film.
Absolutely,
in the
film. Yeah, very true.
Which subverts everything again with the adult males being children and the 13-year-old girl being the most mature. But I also love that the film sort of is like half makes fun of environmentalism and activism, but also comes down on the hard on the Justice Department and collusion between corporations and the government and all this stuff. It's pretty intense stuff going on.
This is a world where I think like everybody is wrong on some level.
Right. Yeah.
Which is cool. And it's kind of like an amalgamation of like all of the 1970s too. Right. Like it says 1977, but it's also like it kind of throws in like you got the protests and like all the smog pollution in Los Angeles, and you've got the gas thing as part of it where there's
the gas shortage.
The gas shortage is there too.
Yep.
There's all this different stuff. And there's so many like surprises in this movie. I can't even talk about them yet because we're not in spoilers. But there's so many things where like you watch it and like every 5 minutes I feel like there's something like out of left field. It's like, whoa, that's something I haven't seen.
Yeah. Yeah. I was reminded a lot about of Inherent Vice in this.
Yeah. I see that. Also. Yeah. I think partially the 70s setting would be.
Right. Partially it's the 70s setting and the detective story about a guy who's just like total bumbling, has no idea is way in over his head.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So should we move into spoilers, Mike, so we can talk about some of these surprises?
I think we should. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff that happens in this movie that I want to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. So definitely both of us big fans of the movie. Check it out. I think it's my favorite movie of the year right now. It's so good.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move into spoilers for The Nice Guys starting right now. All right. Spoilers for The Nice Guys starting right now. So the biggest surprise to me in this movie is that the movie revolves around this character, Amelia, who Gosling and Crowe are looking for the entire time. And she's played by Margot Qualley from The Leftovers. She played Jill on The Leftovers.
Yes.
And so the biggest surprise to me was that Amelia dies about like 3/4 of the way through the movie while there's still like a bunch of movie left.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like the narrative revolves around her like the entire time she's alive. And so when she dies, it made it seem like the movie was about to end.
I thought that was going to be it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it seemed like it was going to end on kind of like a bum note, like a down note. But that wasn't the case at all. It still like went on for like another like 20 to 30 minutes.
Yeah.
A fantastic climax sequence. I might add.
God. Yeah. I thought it was going to end there and I was like, oh, it's The Nice Guy. It's cause they finished last. That's shitty. Shane Black, how could you? But then there was another 25 minutes left.
Right. Yeah. Here's something. So this past weekend, Neighbors 2, the Angry Birds movie, and The Nice Guys were all released.
Okay.
What do they all have in common besides their release date?
I have no idea.
Hannibal Buress is in all of them.
What?
Playing very small roles in each one. He was the voice of Bumble, the bee in Gosling's dream sequence.
Oh my god. That's phenomenal.
Yeah. That's pretty neat. That whole dream sequence was amazing.
Yeah, it's very Naked Lunch, which I thought was nice. Yeah, that was bizarre shit. And there's a couple moments like that, other moments in this film.
Yep.
Which I love the just like fantastical weirdness that happens. I don't even know how else to put it.
Yeah, I mean, also similarity to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. This is the second movie that Shane Black has directed, in which a dead president comes back. From the dead during a character's vision.
Yep. I forgot about that.
So in the first movie, this joke where like, oh yeah, just bring everybody back. Let's bring like making a joke about how like, characters come back to life all the time in movies. And so it's like, oh, let's just bring everybody back. Hey, Abraham Lincoln's alive. Like, hey, look at this.
And Abraham Lincoln Elvis and Abraham Lincoln walk in.
Yeah. And in this movie, Russell Crowe has like the speech about this man who was in a car accident And Richard Nixon was the one who went over to go and help him as he died. And how yeah. weird a sight that would be as you're dying to see Richard Nixon like lying in front of you. And so eventually later on in this movie, Russell Crowe is in the pool. I think it's Russell Crowe is in the pool, right? Or Ryan Gosling? It's
Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Gosling is in the pool. And he's like about to die, or he thinks he's about to die. And then Richard Nixon like swims up to him and says, like, go up, go up.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. But that scene where Russell Crowe explains that story is is Ryan Gosling's like, so why would you tell that whole story? And I feel like that's moments where like an editor would have said, like, that sounds like an editor talking. Like, you could just get to, you don't have to have this whole story, just cut to the point. And
it's, it's pretty great. And yeah, I mean, yeah, and so there was that whole Nixon thing was great. One of the things that struck me as a little odd, Holly was very much averse to killing. Like, she made it a thing where, she wouldn't let Russell Crowe kill the guy who was attacking them. And on the one hand, I get it.
Yes.
Because, like, she's a little girl. So, like,
yeah.
And it makes sense. She's kind of like the moral compass of this whole movie. But also, like they are being attacked by, like, all kinds of different death that yeah. is surrounding them. And so it seemed like an odd line to draw in this kind of story. You know, she's, like, people are actively trying to kill Holly.
Yeah.
Like, throughout the movie. But she won't allow the same to them, which, you know, it's... I just thought it was, like, a weird line to draw in a movie that, like, has a lot of death and super violence in
it. Yeah, it feels pretty odd. Especially because of the fact that it's not even, like... Russell Crowe is redeemed in any way, his character, by the end of the film.
Right.
Like, I think the next scene is them drunk at a bar.
It is. And that's part of the thing. Like, the end of this movie, I was talking about this movie has, like, the cynical worldview, which I appreciate. Like, the character development of this movie is that at the end of the movie, Gosling meets up with Crowe at a bar. Crowe hasn't been drinking the entire time. Yeah. Ryan Gosling has, very much.
Yep.
And Russell Crowe is drinking. And Ryan Gosling says, hey, at least you're drinking again.
Right.
And that's, like, the resolution for the character.
Right.
And there's another line that's like, oh, you know, we're all going to be driving electric cars in 5 years. So, you know, it's not going to be a problem. When obviously that was not the case.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things. And just that whole plot line about the over story, I guess. I don't know, whatever. Of that Kim Basinger's character is prosecuting the Detroit motor manufacturers for colluding to keep the catalytic converter out of cars. And that whole, she gives a whole speech about, you know, even if I'm not there, someone will be there to protect Detroit. And like that whole just awful realization, like that whole philosophy about the government and corporations and stuff.
Yep.
Very poignant for today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, actually Kim Basinger appearing in the movie. I didn't know she was in the movie until I saw the opening credits, which I thought, yeah. And I thought her role was in, like, a nice nod to her role in LA Confidential. That was kind of what I got from that, which was kind of cool. And it's a pretty small appearance, but it's nice. It's cool.
Yeah.
What'd you think of Matt Bomer as John Boy, the serial killer?
It was creepy as shit. It's mostly the haircut, I think.
Yeah.
He was awesome. I'm glad that he was in it. He's cool. This film has lots of like, Shane Black must love the 70s, I guess. There's, like, lots of references to old stuff in it. And I think the Waltons John Boy tie-in joke is pretty hilarious.
Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah.
I mean, also, did you see coming where the story was going at a certain point? Like, Kim Basinger's secretary was kind of the one organizing this whole thing?
There's the moment she makes the phone call that to Ryan Gosling and says, we need to make a drop of $100,000 to someone, can you do it?
Yeah.
After that point, I was kind of like, oh, okay.
Right.
I get it.
Like, she's definitely involved in some capacity. But yeah, I thought, like, her scene where she has Crowe and Gosling at gunpoint and Holly walks in and just, like, throws coffee on her. And once again, you expect her to, like, scream because it's scalding hot coffee, but it turns out to be cold.
Yeah.
So she's just like, why did you just throw cold coffee on me? Yeah. And then she slips with the coffee.
And then falls. Yeah, that was the best. And then I love just how like stupid, how long the scene goes to allow Ryan Gosling to come to the realization that she's in on it. He's like, someone switched out the briefcase. There was no money.
Yeah, and also Ryan Gosling's bit where he's trying to grab the gun from Russell Crowe's ankle.
Yeah.
Which he dreamed. Right. That was part of his dream sequence. And I was genuinely like, oh, yeah, he's going to get the gun from his ankle. And then, and like the more confused Russell Crowe was like, I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That was part of the dream sequence. And yeah, it was hilarious. Ryan Gosling does some amazing physical comedy in this movie, really. Like, he's rolling down hills and like...
Yeah.
You know, just doing like Lou Costello impressions like the entire time. Like, it's great.
Yeah. That was one of my favorite moments. There's a straight up reference to having Costello meet Frankenstein. I had to rewatch it. It's not exactly, but I'm pretty sure it is. when Ryan Gosling discovers the body after he falls down the hill, even though we're in spoilers, I won't say which body. And he lights, okay. I don't know, because why not? He lights the. Light, you know, he's trying to light a cigarette. When it lights up, he sees the body behind him, and it's the scene in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein when they are unloading Dracula into the wax museum, and he sees Dracula, and he's trying to call. Abbott is trying to call Costello. There we go. Got it.
I like that you forgot their names, even though you said Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. I forgot which one's like 10 times.
Shut up. And he's trying, but all he can do is exhale. He can't actually say. He's just
right.
He's just trying to call his friend, but all he can do is exhale for a while.
Yep,
which was amazing because that's one of my favorite movies. It's great.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, what did you think some of the best scenes in The Nice Guys were? Like, we talked about a lot of the disparate things. One of my favorites was the protest group that was pretending to be dead.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Which was hilarious. Like, that went on forever and. resulted in Chet, who was hilarious because every time they were just like, fucking Chet.
Fucking Chet. Yeah. That's pretty great. What else was there that was hilarious? It's kind of just great throughout. There are moments that are funnier than others. Ryan Gosling, the whole him being wasted at the house party trying to find Amelia. And he just, as he progressively gets more and more drunk, he's asking the wrong questions and stuff.
I think one of my favorite moments is at that party at the porn house. Holly is like in the trunk of the car. She like snuck in with them, and like you hear the bang on the car. Ron Gosling goes over there, opens it, sees Holly, and she's like, "Listen, like since I'm here, I might as well come in." And he just shuts the trunk, shuts the trunk, and walks over and like tries to get the valet's keys. And the guy's like, "I can't take it like that. Like, yeah. I can't take your car like that."
Yeah, I love it. I think the pacing and just comedic timing and willingness to let a scene go on for a long time, like that scene with the protesters, takes forever to get where it's going, but it's
hilarious,
so funny.
Time.
Yeah, yeah. Just the shenanigans that are happening.
Yes, I also really liked when Amelia comes to the house they bring her to the house. She's passed out,
right?
And Holly's friend is there. I think Janet or Jennifer or something. She just like adds like things to the conversation every once in a while. She has no idea what they're talking about.
Yep.
But she's
just
like,
there
chiming in like every once in a while. I also really liked Ryan Gosling's hatred of her friend Janet. Like, that was pretty great.
Yeah. That was a pretty great recurring joke of, the one you like, Jessica or Janet or whichever one. But I love, Ryan Gosling's, assumption that he's a pretty great detective, but he's not. Just how cocky he is when he figures out that the address is not a flight. That he he's like, oh, flat Hollywood, whatever apartments, and he's like, well, it's European dates, haha. And they get to where they think the thing is, and the building's been torn down.
It's like, all right, to the airport.
Yeah,
I think the best part about that scene is like, you know, it's at the point in the movie where Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling are kind of fighting, and they had like a split, and Russell Crowe's at the house, but he's like giving up on Gosling, and Gosling is like, he's like, yeah, you could go to the airport, but you'd be going to the wrong place, and he like calls back to him, and like Russell Crowe stops, and Ryan Gosling looks at his daughter like, did he stop? In his tracks.
Yeah. basically, this movie's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's really, really funny. It's really engaging. Like, it's an intense plot. That's like it's a really interesting mystery that they're investigating. And I hope to God that there's a sequel. You know, I feel like there's like perfect ground for a sequel to exist. Like maybe a version in the '80s or something.
Yeah.
I don't think this movie made a ton of money, so I doubt a sequel is in the cards. Plus, I know Shane Black is busy doing Predator next.
Right.
Which is pretty cool. That's pretty wild.
That'll be awesome. Yeah. Yeah, and I also, you have to give them credit, or Shane Black credit, I guess, that, you know, a cheaper version of this movie would have been that it's in the 70s.
Right.
And that had no, there was kind of no joke about that, really.
Right, there was just kind of an aesthetic thing.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. I don't know. I could just about, like, I could see them doing, I don't know, whatever lame 70s jokes about it being the 70s. But this is the scene, I thought was really funny when Ryan Gosling's on the phone and I think he finds out that there's the party and he hands Holly the phone and he's like, hang this up. And she just throws it on the table. I don't know why that really got me. Basically, Holly is the best part of this movie.
Holly is fantastic. And she should get her own spinoff where she's like a kid detective solving mysteries in these like seedy underground places.
I'm on board.
HBO series. Holly, Kid Detective.
Done.
I'm in. All right. So, Mike, it sounds like you're a big fan.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was also a big fan. So definitely check this movie out if you can. It's awesome. It's so good. So, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
Find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I stream our games sometimes at twitch.tv/geonerd79.
And you can find me at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog, as well as all of my podcasts at filmbook.com, where I podcast by Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Gotham, and our other podcast, The Complete Works, also at filmbook.com. Thank you guys so much for listening to Filmbookcast. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We produce so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us next for a new episode of The Complete Works, in which Mike and I will be discussing Nicolas Cage's role in Christopher Coppola's 0% of Rotten Tomatoes film, Deadfall.
Oh, this is going to be the best.
I'm pretty stoked. From what I hear, Cage goes nuts in it, too, so... You know,
perfect.
Always a good time. And then join us next time we meet where we'll likely be discussing X-Men Apocalypse. You ready, Mike?
Yeah. I don't know if hopefully we survive the end of the world.
Hopefully. I mean, we'll have to because we got to make it to Ragnarok. That's well, the next end of the world.
There you go. Good point.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting. I don't know. I've heard pretty mixed things about X-Men Apocalypse so far. But I liked X-Men First Class a lot, and I also like Days of Future Past. So,
right.
See where this goes. I am interested to see how they're handling the decades thing, because somebody has pointed out X-Men First Class took place in the 70s. Days of Future Past that was in the 60s. Days of Future Past in the 70s. This one's in the 80s, which means effectively all of these characters have aged 20 years at least in the span of these three movies that have been released like 5 years apart.
Right. That's a good point.
And these movies have done nothing to like age up the characters in any way.
Yep, not at all.
Like that. And so like Charles Xavier, who was like probably in his 20s in X-Men First Class,
yeah,
is supposed to now be like nearing his 50s.
Yep.
And he'll still be looking like James McAvoy. So.
Yeah, and also they have one or two movies before they catch up to the other timeline.
Yeah, they've been talking about like doing another one, and that one would take place in the 90s. And it's like, well, like, what are you going to do when they get to 2000? Is like Patrick Stewart just going to jump back in, or like what?
Right?
Are you just going to remake X-Men 1 with this new cast? Because like, what's the point of that? So we'll see what happens. We will see what happens. But until then, I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike Tree Show. Thanks for joining us, guys. We'll see you next time. I feel right in this motherfucker.